Illinois now has more than 30,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and a huge share of them are in nursing homes.
We knew even before we got into having the large numbers of long-term care facilities with cases that would be one of our hardest areas.
We'll look at one particular cluster in central Illinois and hear details about the new order to keep schools closed for the rest of the academic year. Plus, COVID-19 is prompting many of us to confront the uncomfortable reality of death. We'll talk about end-of-life planning in a pandemic. And finally, while many people are staying at home, museums are coming to us virtually. We'll take a look inside. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the weekend, authorities announced the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Illinois now exceeds 30,000, and the disease is known to be in all but 9 of the state's 102 counties. Officials also said nearly 1,300 people here have died from the coronavirus disease, but those numbers could have been much higher, and they say they're not only because of the business closures and the stay-at-home order. Given that, just before the weekend, Governor J.B. Pritzker made it clear Illinois will not be getting anywhere near a pre-COVID normal anytime soon.
Folks, I've said time and time again, my decisions are hard ones, but they will follow the science. And the science says our students can't go back to their normal routine. Therefore, I am suspending in-person learning in schools for the remainder of the 2019-2020 school year.
Meanwhile, the State Department of Public Health on Saturday for the first time released numbers of all the positive tests and deaths linked to long-term care facilities. But as with so much on the coronavirus, the statistics are likely too low to capture what's really happening out there. Joining us to talk about these issues are Jim Meadows, a reporter for WILL and Illinois Newsroom, and Nader Issa, education reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Jim, Nader, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jim, let's start in Decatur. I understand that well more than half of the known COVID-19 cases reported in Macon County are from a single nursing home. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that single facility is called Fair Havens Senior Living. It's in Decatur. And of the 54 confirmed COVID-19 cases in Macon County, at least 33 cases are linked to Fair Havens, with residents or employees. But at least one out of the 4 latest group facility cases are from a second nursing facility, Villa Clara. They reported a single case last week, and beginning this past weekend, the Macon County Health Department stopped giving specifics. But we do know that so far all 9 deaths from COVID-19 in Macon County are residents who were at Fair Havens.
Do we know why there were so many cases at this one facility, and how is Fair Havens handling this?
That's an open question. The newspaper indicator, the Herald and Review, interviewed a family member of a Fair Havens resident who had COVID-19. She said she had to repeatedly call and, in her words, throw fit after fit to get her brother seen by a doctor. He was subsequently tested positive, and according to the Herald and Review, is now recovering. Meanwhile, local officials in Macon County have asked the Illinois Department of Public Health for help in relation to Fair Havens. They want expanded testing at the facility to cover all staff and residents, not just at one part of the facility where the first cases appear. And they want more training of the staff for the proper use of personal protective equipment. A family of a resident posted photos of social media purportedly showing a staff at Fair Havens failing to wear their PPE properly. Now, as I mentioned before, Villa Clara, that second nursing facility, reported a resident testing positive for COVID-19 last week. They have been emphasizing, apparently in reaction to the Fair Havens case, their own safety measures and how the resident, a recent arrival, was still in initial quarantine and was tested while hospitalized for a different ailment.
So Jim, let's take a step back here, because as I mentioned a few moments ago, Decatur is certainly not alone in facing a cluster of cases concentrated at a nursing home, right?
Or not necessarily nursing homes, but what are called congregate living facilities, especially ones like senior apartments or assisted living facilities that house elderly people who may have other health problems. I know in my my hometown of Park Forest in Cook County, there's a case involving a developmental center with a big flare-up of cases. In Christian County, a county with a smaller population just southwest of Macon County, a majority of that county's 25 COVID-19 cases to date are linked to two facilities in Taylorville, Rolling Meadows Senior Living and the Park Glen Apartments. Park Glen just got off a two-week quarantine for their residents. And by comparison, Effingham County, with a similar population to Christian County, about 34,000-35,000. They don't have a cluster of cases at a congregate living facility, and they have just four COVID-19 cases reported for the entire county. Of course, a lot depends on how many have been tested and other factors that may still be undetermined.
Yeah, and as I mentioned over the weekend, the state started releasing some new numbers about long-term care facilities, and the Tribune aggregated those and found that nearly one in four of Illinois' COVID deaths have been someone from a nursing home. So that was one of the big stories since our last broadcast. Another is that Governor Pritzker basically canceled in-person instruction for the rest of this school year for K-12 in Illinois. I want to bring Nader Issa of the Chicago Sun-Times into the conversation. Nader, what does this order mean for testing and grades and how students are going to be able to get through the rest of this school year?
Well, that's still a little bit unclear. State education officials have essentially said standardized testing is done for the year. So things like the SAT or other forms of testing for school ratings, for student assessment, those are canceled. As far as grades go, that's the part that's still up in the air. Officials are telling districts to be lenient with grades. They don't want any student's grade to go down because of a bad assignment or because they don't have access to a computer, to internet. And so that has sort of been where grading has been so far. Mm-hmm. But going forward now, schools are moving into the fourth quarter, and it's still unclear whether the state wants districts to give out report cards, give out concrete grades, or whether they'll move to something like a pass, no pass system or a pass fail system.
Do we know, what about high school seniors? Are they going to be able to get to graduate? Maybe not with a ceremony, but, you know, still get their diploma?
Yeah, so they, by all accounts, high school seniors will still get their diploma. It just likely won't be in front of their family and friends at a big ceremony. At this point, and ceremonies would be in about a month, month and a half, and it's just unclear if the science is going to prove that it's safe to gather like that at that time. We're going to have to wait and see. Schools are already talking about some alternate form of ceremony, like an online meeting, virtual meeting, where families can celebrate their students, but in-person graduations seem at this point unlikely.
You had an interesting story over the weekend, and I'm glad you did, because I feel like it's something that people are thinking about, but I haven't seen talked about openly as much, which is parents are worried about the loss of learning. And, you know, there are some who are thinking about having their kid repeat the same grade. I wonder, what reaction did you hear from state and education officials about that idea?
Well, the idea sort of has been spurred in the last few weeks because of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis making that announcement that he's going to allow parents who want to hold back their kids' grade to do so. And so the governor was asked about that on Friday, and Governor Pritzker basically said he hadn't really talked about that with his education team, but that he would look into it and see if that was an option for this state. But everything that the governor has said, everything that state education officials have said, is that students should be still progressing on to the next grade. Education research shows that there isn't really any benefit. There actually is a bit of harm in leaving kids in their current grade and not letting them progress. And a lot of teachers, a lot of educators have said the same thing. if any loss of learning needs to be made up, the time to do it is next year in the new grade and not necessarily repeating a grade that until now, three quarters of which has already been done.
Yeah, and just about 20 seconds left here, but I wonder, speaking of next year and trying to make that up, do we know anything about next school year? I mean, you mentioned the science is not clear about large gatherings. I mean, is it any more clear about whether we can have school in August as opposed to June?
It's not really. I mean, a lot of the doctors are saying things really won't be back to normal until we have a vaccine, which at this point is about a year away. So it's hard to say that it's going to be normal next year. But will there be some form of in-person education? Maybe. It's just really hard to tell what's going to happen a month from now, much less in August and September and October.
Well, we'll certainly follow this story and stay with it. Nader Issa is an education reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. We also spoke with Jim Meadows, a reporter for Illinois Newsroom. Thank you both for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Healthcare workers face serious risks caring for patients who have COVID-19. Bryce and Brittany Butimer are among them. They're a married couple living in Kankakee, working in neighboring Will County. They're on the front lines of the pandemic as a paramedic and an ER nurse. They've also made another sacrifice amid this crisis, living apart from their three children. Their story is part of a series, Essential Voices, from Side Effects Public Media. Let's take a listen.
My name's Bryce Butimer. I'm a paramedic firefighter.
My name is Brittany Butimer, and I have been an emergency room nurse for the last 3 years.
Most of the calls are just still your typical 911 emergency medical calls, but we're taking most of the precautions that everybody has to COVID-19. We wear masks, N95s, and we bring in surgical masks for the patient and family no matter what the call is.
I'd say for over a month now, we've been seeing patients with these symptoms. The consensus seems to be that we've been seeing this since January, but we just didn't know what it was. It definitely is anxiety provoking for sure. You know, I've heard a lot of nurses say, well, we didn't sign up for this, but we did sign up for this. And that's why we all continue to show up, because we love our patients. The problem we're seeing with this virus is that patients are showing minor symptoms. They are absolutely okay to discharge. And then suddenly people are progressing to worsening. We're having a lot of cardiac arrests on patients that were fine an hour ago, and now they aren't. One of the hardest things is that when these patients are crashing, or we see that they're crashing, trying to stop yourself from just running into the room without any kind of gear on is extremely heartbreaking. You have to make sure that you're covered. I know there's been several times where, you know, if we can just get a mask and goggles on, we gotta go, because these patients are dying very quickly. It's been a completely new experience for us. I've had a patient that I sat with as he died because these families can't come into the hospital. That has been extremely hard, because nobody should ever have to die alone. And we will always make sure no one ever dies alone. We will always be there with them. When we started seeing these really extreme cases, my husband, who is a firefighter paramedic, and since I'm an emergency room nurse, we are both around it and we both can't take time off. So we decided to have our three children go to my parents' house.
Knowing what she's seeing and what she's dealing with, you know, that helped make my decision into agreeing with her to have the children go over and stay at her parents' house for the time being. It was a hard decision, but they understood what was going on. They know what me and Brittany do for our jobs, especially our oldest, who's 11. He does understand.
Our middle is 8, and our youngest, he is only a year and a half. So he's the only one who doesn't understand.
We text back and forth, video chat with them. A couple times a week, we see if they need anything. We drop stuff off, and if they come outside, we stay away from them, you know. No hugs, no kisses, anything like that. But, you know, they'll show us, you know, some stuff that they've been doing at their grandparents' house, making forts and whatnot and driving tractors around. Our youngest, Kyler, you know, he doesn't understand why mom and dad can't pick him up. And why, you know, after 10, 15 minutes, you know, we blow him kisses and we get in the car and we leave.
It's been extremely hard. My children are pretty much everything in the world to me.
It's so quiet in her house, you could hear a pin drop. It's so strange. So what I'm looking forward to most is having the kids back in the house, having them yelling and screaming, toys all over the place, them in the backyard jumping on the trampoline, you know, just being able to be their dad and hold them and hug them. I just want the kids to know that, you know, mom and dad love them, that we're doing this for their best interest, and that this is all going to be over soon, and nothing like this hopefully will ever happen again. Can't wait to hold them again.
Those were the voices of Bryce and Brittany Budimir, a paramedic and nurse in Kankakee, who are eagerly awaiting the end of the COVID-19 pandemic. And that story was produced by Illinois Newsroom's health reporter, Christine Herman, who joins me now. Christine, welcome back to the 21st. Just about a minute right now for us to chat here about this. But I'm wondering, how common was Brittany and Bryce's experience?
Yeah, so Brian, it was, you know, they were very clear that they were able to make this choice because they have parents nearby. You know, I spoke with the head of the Illinois Nurses Association, who said there are many nurses who, you know, would love to be able to have that kind of support system, but simply don't. So they, you know, they have concerns about what kinds of risk factors they're exposing their family members to when they come home.
And are there different ways that nurses in different parts of the state are being affected by this? I mean, they were up in Kankakee, which is part of the Chicago area.
Yeah, so, you know, the head of the Nurses Association, Susan Swart, she basically told me that, you know, there's big cities like Chicago where we're seeing obviously a lot of COVID-19 cases. The nurses and health workers there are taking on extra shifts and they're really busy. In other parts of the state, she says, you know, actually nurses and other health workers have been sent home because elective surgeries have been canceled. The hospitals have transitioned to just be less busy and they haven't yet been hit by COVID-19. And so it's, you know, she said it's a little strange. They're watching things on the news about the developments. They want to be able to help, but they're not needed in their own local areas. So there's that interesting discrepancy between urban and rural areas.
All right. Well, Christine Herman, thanks for doing the story. Thanks for sharing it with us today and spending a couple of minutes extra talking with us about it. You're listening to The 21st. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Perhaps the most difficult aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic is confronting the uncomfortable reality of death. As of this broadcast, Monday morning, more than 1,200 people have died in Illinois, and more than 40,000 have died across the country because of the coronavirus. Many others have been brought to what they thought was the brink, landing in ICUs or on ventilators, texting loved ones where to find important documents in case they didn't make it out. And because of the nature of the virus and its contagiousness, a patient's final days look different, with no visitors allowed and families having to mourn their loved ones alone. It's a terrible thing to talk about, but something many of us are being forced to plan and discuss, regardless of our age or underlying health conditions. Our two guests today can help bring some perspective and offer advice when it comes to end-of-life planning. University of Illinois Law Professor Richard Kaplan joins us. He specializes in health and elder law and actually developed one of the first law school courses on the topic. He also authored Elder Law in a Nutshell. Professor Kaplan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us from Bloomington is Dr. Paul Peterson. He's an internist and chief medical officer for OSF St. Joseph Medical Center there, and is the immediate past president of the Illinois State Medical Society. His term actually just concluded over the weekend. Dr. Peterson, welcome to the 21st as well.
Thank you so very much for having us on.
So according to a recent New York Times article, only 1 in 3 American adults have completed advance directives. Why do you think that number is so low, Professor Kaplan?
There are a variety of reasons. First of all, most people don't want to think about death. Secondly, there's not been as much attention to these forms as there has been to other forms such as wills. Wills have been around for nearly 5 centuries, and the majority of Americans don't have them either. The fact remains that people can find these forms on the websites of all kinds of places and in hospitals and medical offices, But for the most part, there's a lot of denial. They don't want to think about themselves being unable to communicate, and that percentage of one-third is actually distributed very differently across age groups, so that older people, it's much higher, and younger people, it's much lower, even though many of the famous cases from Terri Schiavo on down have been of young women or young people more generally in their 20s.
And Dr. Peterson, what about you? Do you have a sense as to why that number is so low?
I think Professor Kaplan is absolutely correct. There's a lot of denial about the issue of facing death, and it's a fear of perhaps oftentimes not being dead, but of dying and the process of dying. And these documents can give you significant control over that process of how you want that to happen. And if you, in the instance in which you're not able to make decisions, you have named someone, a healthcare power of attorney, to be able to make those decisions for you. It's about your decisions, not about theirs.
Mm-hmm. And I want to remind our listeners that if you want to join the conversation or if you have questions or comments for our guests, our number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21ST Show, 21st Show. Professor Kaplan, when we talk about end-of-life planning, what does that entail? For example, what is an advance directive versus a will?
It's a great question, and people interpret it in various ways. In fact, I've gotten a couple calls recently by young parents who were concerned about creating a property will. It's typically not what's meant as an advance directive, but sometimes people will subsume that within the category of end-of-life planning. But for the most part, end-of-life planning is understood as creating some sort of advance directive, pretty much what Dr. Peterson was talking about. One common form is a durable power of attorney for health care, where a person doesn't make any specific decisions, just designates a person to whom medical providers can ask what should be done in this circumstance. The other common form is called a living will. It's not as popular, but for many people, it establishes exactly what they're looking for. Namely, it indicates that under certain circumstances, typically when they're terminal, they don't want certain procedures done if all they're going to do is delay death. And so it's a matter of whether you want to indicate whether a person should not proceed with certain so-called death-delaying procedures, or whether you simply want to say that if I cannot speak for myself, here is the person I want you to consult.
And Dr. Peterson, have you had to confront situations where these end-of-life plans were not in place?
It happens daily, unfortunately. Oh. And that is the challenge of this. And frequently, it's not so much the paper, but those conversations that need to happen between the person who's thinking about this and the decision makers or the family who's around. Very frequently, we'll have, mom who is in her last moments of life and hasn't made any decisions about this. And, a cousin from California calls and says, oh, you got to keep mom alive until I get there. Those are very challenging times for people, and it really is helpful to get this done up front and have those discussions. Yeah, the discussions end up in paper, as Professor Kaplan has talked about. But, the saying is it's never too early until it's too late.
Yeah, and do you end up being the intermediary in those cases as a physician?
As a physician, you end up trying to figure out who is going to be the decision maker. What was it that mom really wanted? And frequently the families are not in agreement about what mom might have wanted. And therein lies the challenge, because mom knew exactly what she wanted in most instances. She just didn't let anybody know.
And Professor Kaplan, so what are some of the plans that everyone should have in place? Like, does everybody need an advance directive?
I would say so. That is, if people have strong views as to what they want done to them when they can't speak, then they need to make that clear. And as Dr. Peterson indicated, whether it's in the form of paper or just conversations, these are uncomfortable conversations, but they need to happen. A lot of times people just don't imagine they'll be in that situation. And following on his wonderful aphorism that I love about never too early until it's too late, a similar kind of idea is that you don't need this until you do, and then it's too late. That is, these forms need to be completed or these discussions need to be had while the person is still competent. They can properly say, I don't need this now. I can speak for myself, and they're absolutely right. But the fact is they need to do it before it's needed. And what sometimes intimidates some people is they're a little concerned that the decision they make today, they may feel differently about when the time actually comes. And a point that they should know about is you aren't making irrevocable decisions. That is, as long as a person is competent, they will be able to say what they want done. These forms or these discussions are only relevant if it comes to the point where they can't tell you what's done.
And how do you go about completing an advance directive then? I mean, is there a, you know, just download something on the internet and fill it out, or do you have to call a lawyer? How does that work?
You can certainly go to websites. The Illinois, I think the Medical Society has free forms. They are typically state specific. So if people are living in Missouri or Illinois, they want to get the Illinois forms. But they are available if one were to go in any hospital or nursing home. Typically, as part of the admission process, these forms have to be presented. But sometimes people would rather do it when things are a little bit more leisurely. And so they can find these forms on the web. Some people like to discuss these with their physician, and others want to talk about this with an attorney as part of an estate planning process independently. Usually around April 15th, there's something that some law schools will hold called Medical Decisions Day, where they help people fill these out. Typically, law students are doing it during this time of pandemic. Of course, all these interactions have been suspended. But if people just want to look over these forms, they can find them on the web, as well as a fair amount of guidance as to who you should be asking to do the decision making.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Richard Kaplan from the University of Illinois College of Law and Dr. Paul Peterson, Chief Medical Officer at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington. We've been speaking about end-of-life planning and some things that people of all ages can have prepared, regardless of their health. And remember, you can always join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Dr. Peterson, particularly in the context of COVID-19, how do these decisions assist doctors or family members if they've been made ahead of time?
Well, certainly the elderly and infirm are having a worse time with this virus. There's an occasional young person who is in pretty darn good health and has a significant problem with this virus. But certainly the elderly and the infirm already have significant challenges. And if they haven't made those decisions beforehand, sometimes being on a ventilator for 2 to 3 weeks to get through this is really not what they wanted to do. So it's important to make sure that everybody has, and I agree with Professor Kaplan, there's no reason not to have one, an advance directive of some form. But especially in this time, I think it's really important for those folks because, as you mentioned, there's no visitors coming in. You can't be around, and it's hard to get that same feel for how mom or dad or cousin is doing in the hospital over the phone. Even with video conferencing, it's challenging to see how they're doing and what's really happening. So it's very important. Illinois State Medical Society has a whole booklet that starts in how to start that conversation, and then has all those forms available. So that you can pick and choose between them, a pulsed form, physician order for life-sustaining treatment, a living will, a standard form for healthcare power of attorney. A variety of those are all in that packet and can be downloaded from ISMS.org.
And we'll have a link to that on our Twitter page. You can find that at 21st Show on Twitter. Professor Kaplan, as we just heard Dr. Peterson saying, this virus it can be serious for people of all ages, but younger adults have had a lower death rate than older adults. But even so, Professor, you would, I think, probably say that it's still important for younger people to have these plans in place, even if we weren't experiencing a pandemic, right?
Well, that's certainly true. And as Dr. Peterson pointed out, there are younger people who are succumbing to it. It's a lower percentage. But one never knows whether they're going to be in that small percentage. And among other things, one of the concerns of younger people is this how you want your remaining dollars, if it's going to be a matter of copayment for certain procedures to be spent? Or do you think the family would be better off in other ways? And what a lot of people don't realize is they think that if they don't fill out a form, this will never happen to them. It doesn't work that way. And with the COVID-19 in particular, people really don't know when they're coming into contact with infected people. And so it may literally sneak up on them, and they may not have as much time to plan and to hold these discussions as they like. In addition, Illinois has what's called the healthcare surrogacy statute, which indicates that if a person has not completed a form, there will be a designated list of decision makers that are provided. It may not, however, be the list that people want, and therefore it's particularly incumbent on younger people to see if they want a particular person. It may be a cousin who is medically informed, and that person would be a better designated decision maker than, say, their spouse or their adult child. Then they need to affirmatively designate that person.
So only a couple of minutes left in our conversation today, but Dr. Peterson, it can be really difficult to have these conversations. People, as we said at the beginning, don't like to talk about death. They don't like to think about it. Dr. Peterson, do you have any advice for how to get families to talk about end-of-life planning?
Well, I think it starts with the recognition that we're all going to die. We don't all, the saying is, the only thing that's sure is death and taxes. Well, you don't have to pay taxes. You can go to jail. But you do have to die. And now you have the opportunity to control some of that and some of those ways that the things that are going to happen to you during that time that may not necessarily be for you. And I think that's where that happens. I had a discussion years ago with a lady who had been on a ventilator off and on. She had terrible lungs, and she was having this discussion with her husband. She said, "I never, ever, ever want to go on that ventilator again." And he said, "Well, honey, I'm not sure I can do that." And she said, "Well, I'm going to get somebody who will then." So it's important to have that discussion and start off that discussion with, here's how I think about my life and how I want to end it and how I think about the amount of suffering that I want to go through at the end of my life.
And Professor Kaplan, just about 30 seconds, same question to you. Any advice for getting people to actually have these difficult conversations?
Yeah, I think actually now may be the opportune time. Namely, the COVID-19 is wall-to-wall coverage. And so people are thinking about these kinds of issues. It's not an inappropriate time to say, wow, if this happened to me, what would we do?
All right. We're going to leave it there that we have been speaking with Professor Richard Kaplan, who specializes in elder law and health law at the University of Illinois School of Law, and Dr. Paul Peterson, Chief Medical Officer at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington. He's also the just recently past president of the State Medical Society. Thank you both for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much
for having us.
And a reminder that we will have links to the booklet and forms that they talked about on our website and on our Twitter page, which is 21stshow. Coming up after the break, a little bit lighter subject. Museums may be closed to the public, but with virtual tours, you can still explore exhibits from your home. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. A brief programming note. Later this week, we're interviewing Tim Killeen, the president of the University of Illinois system. Whether or not you're connected to the university, be it a student, parent, faculty, staff, or just a citizen of Illinois, we want to hear your questions for Tim Killeen. Send us an email or, better yet, a voice memo to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can also tweet us your questions at 21st Show. Museums are closed to in-person visitors now, but you can still explore their collections from home. Right now, you can go on virtual tours of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, see Van Gogh's paintings at the Art Institute of Chicago, or, as our next guest will tell you, hear about space exploration from Apollo 13 astronauts. Jessica Bode Frank is Digital Collections Access Manager at Adler Planetarium in Chicago, and she's here to explain more about some of their virtual museum exhibits. And, of course, because everything is virtual now, you can take a trip to museums across the country, not just here in Illinois. We're also joined by Jennifer Herrera with the National Women's History Museum in Washington, D.C. Jessica and Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you so much.
And if you have found a great virtual museum experience while staying at home, let us know by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Jessica, I want to begin with you. For those of us who haven't made it up to visit the planetarium in Chicago in person before it temporarily closed, what can you tell us about it?
The Adler Planetarium is just a really unique space in Chicago. I think it really has something for everybody. I think people really know us for the dome show, so you can come and see some really stunning images of the universe on this, you know, amazing dome. But we also have the Space Visualization Lab, where people can interact with astronomers one-on-one, but also really exciting exhibitions. So we have, you know, our newest exhibition, Chicago's Night Sky, that introduced people not only to modern astronomy topics like light pollution, but also constellations and fine art. So it's kind of something for everyone to get you excited about space.
That's the sort of like what I would call the steampunk planetarium thing, where you kind of slide into this brass sphere or something.
So that's our Atwood Sphere. So pretty much the oldest planetarium in America, inside the oldest planetarium in America. But yeah, that's pretty exciting. They had just refurbished that before November. And so that was, you know, it's one people really enjoy kind of sliding into.
Yeah. And I know my kids like pressing the button on the fake mission control area for the moon missions. I want to ask the same question to Jennifer Herrera about the National Women's History Museum. What is the space like?
Well, so we've existed for two decades as a virtual museum. So we don't yet have a physical presence in Washington, D.C. We're working really hard to get one built in the coming years, in the next couple of years, in fact. And as we pursue an actual physical home of our own, we continue to deliver the incredible amount of resources that we have online for at-home learners and educators and general audiences as well. We have a host of ways you can dig in and explore women's history. Women are largely left out of the history books, despite making up over half of the population. So for two decades, we've curated these incredible resources and exhibits for online visitors. And so it's a great, you know, opportunity for people to really dig in and learn more about these stories that have largely been left out of history.
So Jessica, talking about the planetarium, has it put more resources into online exhibits since having to close to the public?
I think like everywhere that kind of had that physical presence first, we have gotten, you know, one good thing out of this is the ability to invest some more resources. We already had a dedicated program for online exhibitions, as well as interactive projects. Our Zooniverse team had been doing crowdsourcing projects since 2007, and they've had about 2 million registered users so far. But since this has happened, we've gotten to bring in our theaters teams and our guest experience teams, who usually deal with that one-on-one interaction with guests, and start looking at new ways to make all of our programming a little bit more digital, so that we can provide experiences now, but also hopefully be a little bit more global even when we reopen.
Zooniverse, that's the system where citizen science, where you can sort of do sort of little tasks to help scientists find, you know, alien life or things like that?
Yes, the Zooniverse is really great. It's an online platform, and anybody with large data sets can kind of upload them and then use this global network of citizen science to help go through these. And we've seen some really exciting ones where there's transcription projects of H.G. Wells' books, as are some of his notes, as well as some of our constellation images, and then just the real like astronomical images where people are identifying galaxies and all these kind of exciting things that you can pretty much find any project that might trip your trigger there.
Yeah. And I wonder, what are some of the online exhibits you're most excited about that people can explore?
I'd say, again, there's an exhibit for everyone. I've really loved getting to build them all, but we have such a diverse collection at the Adler that our digital exhibits similarly are pretty diverse. The ones I've enjoyed the most are, we had one that launched in July last year for Apollo 11, for their 50th anniversary, called Voices of Apollo. And that one let us celebrate some of the 400,000 people who worked on the Apollo space program who weren't going to be a part of necessarily that anniversary, because we only really think of the three astronauts in the shuttle. And so we got to kind of speak with them and let them add their own words into how amazing that program was. And similarly, we just launched 13 Stories with Captain James Lovell. And so that was for the 50th anniversary of Apollo 13. We interviewed James Lovell and then added his audio to this exhibition so you can hear him talk about, you know, getting through some pretty tough times. And it's pretty exciting to see it kind of up and people responding to it right now.
And we actually have a clip from that interviews with James Lovell of the Apollo 13 crew talking about a moment when he looked back down at the Earth.
As we're orbiting the moon and we're looking back at the Earth, I could put my thumb up to the window and completely hide the Earth. Now you have to think about that for a second. Behind my thumb, over 3 billion people, oceans, deserts, mountains, everything that I used to know, I could put behind my thumb. And I got to thinking of just what is my position in this world.
And that's from an online exhibit at the Adler Planetarium. Jennifer, the National Women's History Museum also has a Women of NASA online exhibit. I wonder, what are some of the other online exhibits people can explore at the Women's History Museum?
Yeah, we have over 30 online exhibits currently on display on virtual display. Everything from Women on the March, about women's peace advocacy and the roots in 19th century U.S. and European movements, to a timeline of the first ladies, women and inventive women, the history of nursing. That's a fascinating one, especially during this pandemic. And then we also have a really wonderful website that we created called Crusade for the Vote, which really it's a timeline and a chronology, and it's filled with a ton of resources about the 100th anniversary, about women's suffrage, and this year we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment ratification. So I would suggest any of those, particularly the Crusade for the Vote.
And I got to say, I was clicking around there myself, and I found an Illinois woman that I had not been familiar with in the past, Ruth Hannah McCormick, who was an advocate for women's suffrage. She went on to become a congresswoman and was apparently the first woman to manage a presidential campaign, Dewey versus Roosevelt in 1940, on the losing side, unfortunately. I understand that there's also an NWH at Home initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to make sure that we have so much online content, obviously, that we've been curating for so many years, but we really wanted to make sure we had content specific for people who are really learning at home and trying to sometimes teach at home. So we created this initiative called NWHM at Home, National Women's History Museum at Home. And every day we offer a new little piece of women's history that you can take with you.
from everything from electronic field trips, which we offer twice a week, which kind of go through some of our exhibits and other content. And then we have a Brave Girl story time where we have museum staff and other special guests reading books for young learners about extraordinary women. We also have a really cool Women's History Minute video. So each Tuesday and Thursday, we have this really, it's about a minute of a woman, so you can know her name and know her story.
Okay. Jessica, I wonder, what are some of the challenges you face when it comes to putting a planetarium online?
Yeah, the planetarium just has so much to offer to guests every single day, but I think one of our best offerings is our one-on-one interactions with guests. And clearly right now, that's just not safe. We were lucky in many regards because we already had a digital exhibition program and our Zooniverse projects were doing really great digital offerings, but that on-site programming like sky shows and public observing and teen programs and just our facilitated daily programs all take time to kind of strategize and figure out how to move to a virtual world. So it's a new world for everyone, and we want to make sure the quality of our content remains high and exciting for everyone. And so that's just been the last month trying to figure out how to really transfer all those things into a fully digital world.
And I mean, I'm sure I gather what you say, and I understand what you say about interacting with the public and missing that. But I mean, is that sort of a positive here that there can be this more of a focus on online, maybe more accessibility, for example?
Yeah, I'd say I think our mission has always been to connect people with the universe and each other under the sky we all share. And right now we're all in this together. And the Adler kind of hopes to bring the wonders of the universe to the world still. So going to fully digital is one of those things that makes it so we can reach more of the world. Not everybody is going to come to Chicago, and not everybody in Chicago can make it to the Adler. We're already seeing our Google exhibits used to really serve about 2/3 of our audiences were global. And in this last month, that's jumped up to 95% of what we're seeing for traffic is coming from global audiences outside the United States. So we're really hoping that we can kind of continue to push these digital experiences to be a little bit more for around the world and a little bit more accessible for people who can't come on site.
So only about a couple of minutes left in our conversation. Jennifer, is there anything that parents or teachers might be particularly interested when it comes to tools for online learning?
Yeah, you know, we offer, I mentioned our Brave Girl story time, along with a video that of us reading the books. We also have a learning resource to work with young kids so they can explore the content from the book itself. But we also have a lot of digital classroom resources, our biographies. We have over 150 biographies of women for children to, well, really anybody to explore. But there's a whole section of our website devoted entirely to students and educators that has a lot of that classroom-ready, digital classroom-ready resources for young learners to dive into.
And I've got to imagine that one downside here, even as maybe there's more interaction online, is that with people not coming into the physical museum, funding can also be tight. And so, Jessica, I wonder, has the planetarium been able to get any help from the CARES Act or some other source at this difficult time?
We're still waiting to hear on some of those like grant-funded opportunities, but we've seen a really great support from our donor base. And I think that's where sometimes it's just really important too for everyone, if you can, to donate. And we've seen some great support there. And so we really appreciate the community we have.
Okay. Jessica Brode-Frank is the Digital Collections Access Manager at Adler Planetarium in Chicago. We also spoke with Jennifer Herrera, Vice President of External Affairs at the National Women's History Museum in Alexandria. Jessica, Jennifer, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Yes, thanks
Thank
for having
so
us.
Much. Really appreciate it.
And once again, I want to remind you, later this week, we'll be interviewing University of Illinois President Tim Colleen. If you have a question for him, whether you're a student, parent, faculty, staff, or just a citizen of Illinois, you have a question for the president of our flagship university, please let us know. Send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. Even better yet, you can send us a voice memo to that address, which once again is talk@21stshow.org. That's all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening, and talk to you tomorrow.